Reese, for many years I've sometimes either arranged or popularized Shirim from YU Rosh Yeshiva when they're in the country. And Rav Reese has several hats. He was a YU Rosh Yeshiva Menahal of the Yeshiva for a number of years. He also has the hat of being the Av Basin of the CRC, as well as a Chavar Basin in the RCA, the Basin of America. So, without further ado, my pleasure to introduce Rav Yonah Reese. Thanks so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rav David. Everybody can take a seat. It's a pleasure to be here. And I have a flight a few hours from now, I'm happy that I was able to hop a little bit of time to be able to share some Divrei Torah with you. And I appreciate that Rabbi Feinberg was able to arrange for this time together. I'm sorry that I missed Rabbi David. I was actually invited to the same event that Rabbi David is at, but this preceded it. So, you know, Baruch Hashem, I'm able to, share various events with Rabbi David. We can each one be a different one. So I was asked to speak about interesting shilas that come up with the Beis Din, and some of the shilas, Rav David was nice enough to bring my Sefer Kanfei Yonah. You can, find the certain shilas discussed over there. But ever since the Sefer was published, there were some new shilas that came up. One of them was anticipated, actually, in my Sefer, but it wasn't anticipated L'maisa. And I guess maybe sadly, on some level, it has actually come up L'maisa on two different occasions since the time that the Sefer was published. You know, during the course of the coronavirus, one of the tragic results of the coronavirus is that you had a lot of people who were nifter, a lot of people passed away before what otherwise would have been their anticipated time. And amongst them were younger people. And as a result, one type of situation that doesn't arise that often nowadays in our community, used to arise a lot more in Europe, is a chalitza situation, where you have a man who dies young without any children, and he leaves behind a wife, and he leaves behind at least one brother. So then the wife has a zika with the brother or with multiple brothers, which means that she's linked to them in such a way that she's not allowed to marry the shuk. She's not allowed to marry anybody else, according to Torah law, unless she does yibum with the brother-in-law, or she does chalitza with one of the brothers-in-law. Chalitza meaning the ceremony that is described in the Torah and Parshas Ki Tetzeh, where the brother-in-law wears a special shoe, and the Yavama, the widow, removes the shoe from the foot, usually the right foot, of the brother-in-law, or says the Kriyas Psukim, the various Psukim that are recited, and she expectorates in the presence of the brother-in-law as well. All of this, the Kriya and the Chalitza and the Vekika, all of this is spelled out in rigorous detail in the Torah. Unfortunately, in the course of the coronavirus, where a number of people died young, we had at least one case where we had to do a chalitza. I actually presided over the chalitza because the fact that the couple alone had only been married for maybe a year or so, the wife did not yet have a chance to become pregnant. There was a brother who was still alive, and the brother-in-law had to perform chalitza with the sister-in-law. And one shaila that had been presented a number of years ago that was described in, that was discussed sort of theoretically in the abstract, came up, I won't say specifically in this situation, because I can't, violate confidentiality, obviously. And we also had another chalitza case this past year with somebody who died of something, unfortunately, other than the coronavirus. But what has, come up in these situations of men dying young is that sometimes when a man dies young, especially if it's due to some sort of a disease where he's going to be getting treatment, he has a machla, unfortunately, he has to get certain radioactive treatments and the like, where he's not going to necessarily be able to procreate, even if he should survive the illness. Certain zera is procured from the husband and is stored away. It's what we call cryovac. The zera is cryovac'd, so that's frozen, so that on some future occasion, the zera could be used to impregnate the wife so that she would be able to have children in the future from his zera. And then if he dies, then he may not be have any children at the time that he dies, but there's still some zera that has the potential of producing children. So the halacha is, in the Torah, uvein ein lo ayein lo, but that the only time the chalitza or yibum is required is when the man left no children. So you have to investigate very carefully, ayena love, to make sure he has no children. Because let's say he didn't have any children from this wife, but he had children from a previous wife, so then that also would exempt this wife from chalitza or yibum, because he did in fact leave a legacy. He left a child or children in the world, so then it wouldn't be necessary to do chalitza or yibum under those circumstances. In fact, there's a big machlokus in the Gemara about whether mitzvahs yibum to kodemus the mitzvahs chalitza, or whether mitzvahs chalitza kodemus the mitzvahs yibum. So we say that you have a choice. You can either do yibum or chalitza. Which one is preferable? Is it preferable to do yibum? Is it preferable to do chalitza? And the halacha is a dispute between the Sfardim and the Ashkenazim, between the Machaber and the Ramah, whether we paskin that yibum is preferable, that's the shita of the Chachamim in the Gemara, or whether we paskin that chalitza is preferable, which is the shita of Abba Shaul. What is the basis for the opinion of Abba Shaul? When you read the Torah, it sounds like we hold the brother-in-law to be in contempt if he refuses to marry the sister-in-law and perform yibum and perpetuate the legacy of his brother by bringing children into the world through the sister-in-law. So why would chalitza come first? So Abba Shaul explains that we're worried that a person might not have the requisite kavanah, that in order to perform the mitzvah of yibum, there has to be kavanah doing it for the purpose of the mitzvah. Otherwise, it's an iser erva, because normally to marry somebody who is the brother's wife is considered to be an iser karis, is considered to be an iser erva. It's something which is a giant prohibition, which is a very severe capital offense. So therefore, it says Abba Shaul, if a person only marries the sister-in-law after she has lost her husband because he likes her, or he thinks she's pretty, or because she's wealthy, or for some other ulterior purpose and motivation other than the mitzvah itself, is ki'ilu pogeh ve'ishasach. It's considered as if there has been a violation of this Isser Erva. Does it mean there's an actual violation of this Isser Erva? Probably not. We generally assume, like the Rishonim would say, that this is a little bit of a guzma. It's an exaggeration. But because of the fact that it's not being performed in the perfect fashion, therefore Abba Shaul says it's preferable not to do it. So the Ashkenazim always follow this approach of Abba Shaul. That's the way that it's paskin in the Ramah. The Mechaber follows the approach that, no, it's still better nowadays to do the mitzvah of Yibum. So the Maritz Chiyus said already a number of hundreds of years ago, maybe 200 years ago, 170 years ago, something like that. So Maritz Chiyus said that nowadays there is another very good reason that we should always prefer the mitzvah of Chalitza over the mitzvah of Yibum. What is that? Because we said that it's going to be a violation of an Isser Erva in the event that the mitzvah doesn't apply. Well, the mitzvah is certainly not going to apply if it turns out that the deceased actually left a child. So says the Maritz Chiyus, we live in a much more promiscuous age. And therefore, we might think that this husband who died didn't leave any children, but maybe he had a relationship with somebody. Maybe he had an out-of-wedlock relationship at some point in his life. He's kept it secret and people don't know about it. And he has a Jewish child from some Jewish woman that he had a relationship with at some point in time. And therefore, that's another reason why nowadays mitzvahs chalitza should always be kodemus to mitzvahs yibum. So it happens that when at the founding of the Medina, back in 1948, there was an Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Yitzchak Isaac Alevi Herzog. There was a Sephardic chief rabbi of Ben Zion Uziel. Both of Herzog and Uziel decided that we want to have a country which is cohesive. The Ashkenazim and the Sephardim all do the same thing. So what's one way of making it cohesive? That we have an agreement about what should happen in these situations. Should you do Yibum? Should you do Chalitza? They both agreed that even for the Sfardim, mitzvahs chalitza is going to be kodemus. That we're going to just have one sort of a principle across the board that will always do chalitza rather than do yibum. So that was all fine and good if all the Sephardic postgame would have gone along with it. But Ravadia Yosef said, how can you possibly go against Maran Beis Yosef? After all, the Machaber paskins that you're supposed to do mitzvahs yibum, and you're yotzim b'yad Ramah. You have the audacity and the gall to follow the Ramah. When Maran Beis Yosef said, mitzvahs yibum comes first. So when he had situations that came in front of him, he totally ignored this takana. Said the takana is batal mevuto from the outset. And therefore, you do yibum, and he paskin in certain situations. He even names the parties in his chuvos. Says sharabi, various names. He says, I paskin for them. If they should do yibum, they want to do yibum. This is the mitzvah, and we're going to do yibum instead. So the question now arises, let's say that the husband had a child during his lifetime. He didn't have a child in sort of the normal procreative fashion. He had the child through artificial insemination. So there's a whole big machlokes between the Beis Shmuel and the Chelkos B'chokek and the Taz and the first Siman of Evan Ezer. If a couple has a child through artificial insemination, has the husband fulfilled his mitzvah pru abu? So the Beis Shmuel has some sort of araya from Agos Smak that talks about how a woman shouldn't lie on bed sheets, you know, of another man because, you know, maybe she'll have a child and that child will be attributed to the other man, and then it'll turn out that one of her children will marry, you know, that child. It'll be a brother or sister marrying each other. So therefore, because maybe this man will have other children and, you know, this child will, you know, marry one of those children. So therefore, she shouldn't sleep on those bed sheets. So it sounds a little bit like there would be a kima pruavu, because the child would be attributed to the other man. So that's Beis Shmuel's raya. But the Chokas Mekokek says, no, it's a suffik. And the Taz says, maybe it's just like l'chumma. We go l'chumma in each direction, but l'chumma, we have to say that maybe there isn't the fulfillment of mitzvah pruavu. So says the Cheshek Shlomo, quoted by the Sefer Chalitza Kilchasa, he says that when it comes to a situation of Yibum or Chalitza, so we have this principle of Uvein Ein Lo Ayein Olav, that you're supposed to do a rigorous examination to see if there is a child anywhere in the world that is attributable or that came from this man who died, and if there is such a child, so then the Medrash Halacha says, Uvein Ein Lo Mikol Makom, that any kind of a bein, whether it's mikol makom, the slightest type of child, is considered to be sufficient in order to exempt the widow from yibum or chalitza. And that's why, for example, the Gemara in Yavama says, Al Chobes says that if the man had a child who was a mamzer, she'll say, ah, the mamzer, what kind of, you know, child is that to have a mamzer? So it doesn't matter. He gave birth to a mamzer because he was involved in some illicit relationship with, I don't know, his aunt or something like that, and the child ends up being a mamzer. So we say, even though the child is a mamzer, that's good enough to exempt his wife from Yibum or Chalitza. I mean, let's say he marries somebody else, and she's exempt from mitzvah Yibum or Chalitza because he had this child who was a mamzer. So it says the Cheshek Shlomo, since we only require a bein mikol makom, the slightest bein is considered to be good enough, so therefore everybody would agree in this particular situation, even though we have a machlokas when it comes to the fulfillment of pruavu in the normal course, whether a child born through artificial insemination is attributable to the father or not, everybody would agree that this child would be attributable to the father, and therefore the widow would be exempted from chalitza or yibum. It's a little bit of a chiddush to say that we'd be more making in this particular circumstance, but the person who wrote the official book on the subject, Chalitza Kehilchasa, were part of the Otsar Poskim series, quoted this Cheshek Shlomo as authoritative. So, you know, if you write the Sefer, you get the Paskin. So it seemed that, you know, we'd probably be makel in this type of a situation, although I could see, you know, a counter-argument potentially. However, there was another type of situation that becomes even more vexing and becomes even more questionable. And that is a situation where the child born from, let's say, artificial insemination or IVF wasn't born in the lifetime of the father, but the child is only born afterwards because the father had left some zera behind, some frozen zera behind. And now he dies, he doesn't have any children. 2 years later, the wife decides that she's going to pick up the zera and she's going to become pregnant from the zera. And she has a child from this man 2 years after he died. So do we say retroactively or at this point in time, that's going to exempt her from chalitza or yibum? So that is a question that was discussed by Rosho Yisraeli, who was, we know, the posek of the Eretz Chemda Institute. It was discussed by Shlomo Zalman Orbach. It was discussed by Rav Nosson Gestetner, who the author of Lahois Nosson. They all had unique perspectives with respect to this shiloh. So Rosho Yisraeli quoted tshuva from the Noda B'Yuda. Noda B'Yuda dealt with the following situation. A man died, didn't have any children, but he left, but his wife became pregnant. His wife was pregnant. He didn't notice at the time that he died that his wife was pregnant, because she wasn't noticeably pregnant at that point in time. Now it happens that we have had those types of situations where there was a man who died and he didn't have any children and the only child was in the mother's womb. So if the child would end up not being viable and he had a brother, so then the wife would require chalitza or yibum. But if the child would be a viable child, so then the wife would not require chalitza yibum. If the child would not be viable, so she would require chalitza yibum. So we had this, you know, when we had this at the Beis Din, I dealt with the tragedy, unfortunately, about 20 years ago, of the World Trade Center cases. And the World Trade Center cases, believe it or not, so we dealt with approximately a dozen cases of men who had disappeared, whose remains couldn't be found, and we had to go through the whole process of collecting testimony and trying to figure out if we had a sufficient identification for halakhic purposes to identify the man as dead or determine that the man had definitely died. so that the wife would be permitted to remarry as a matter of halacha. This is the old-time classical type of aguna case, not the current contemporary aguna cases. Of course, the husband who's only, you know, too much alive and well, but is refusing to give his wife a get. We call that also, appropriately so, an aguna case in order to try to figure out how to convince the husband to give his wife a get. And those are most of the aguna cases that we deal with at the best and nowadays. However, the old-time aguna case that was mostly discussed in the Gemara, when we speak about Mishum Aguna Akilu Be'erabanan, we relax at evidentiary standards. We don't require the testimony of two witnesses. We are content with one witness. The witness doesn't even have to be a normally kosher witness. The witness can even be the wife herself who testifies that she saw the husband dying and she buried him and so forth. So in those types of cases, we have to do, you know, rigorous research in order to determine that they are... The husband was definitely in a place where we have eyewitness testimony that he was in a place where he definitely would have died. So in the World Trade Center cases, for example, we collected testimony from people who had telephone conversations with men who worked in the North Tower of the World Trade Center, where the plane that was commandeered by the terrorists went into the 92nd floor or so of the North Tower and severed the top of the building from the bottom of the building. So it would have been absolutely impossible for anybody who was above the 92nd floor to get down either by elevator or by staircase, by stairwell, because everything had been, all the connections had been completely severed. So as long as we collected testimony from, let's say, a witness who had spoken to the husband after the plane hit the tower, saying where the husband had said, yes, I'm in my office and something happened to the building and we're trying to figure out how to evacuate or whatever, we know that the conversation took place, that would be akin to testimony that the Gemara discusses, where you knew that the man went into a kivshan eish, that the man went into a fiery furnace. One witness saw that the man went into a fiery furnace. So we don't, as Tosafot says, we don't count on miracles for purposes of halakhic dispositions that, you know, he had something happen to him like Hananya, Mishael, Azariah. We assume that if a person went into a fiery furnace, especially if it was a deep fiery furnace where a person couldn't have escaped in the normal course, so then you're allowed to be matir his isha, you're allowed to permit the wife to remarry on the basis of that testimony. So if we had testimony that we knew the man was above the 92nd floor, he worked for Cantor Fitzgerald, which was on the 105th floor and so forth, and we knew that the man was there, so we could permit the wife to remarry under those circumstances. So that is, you know, this type of, you know, case that, you know, you deal with, where you have, you know, these questions regarding the determination of death. So in approximately 4 out of the dozen cases that we dealt with in the aftermath of the World Trade Center, the couple was very, very young, and the wife had not given birth to any other children prior to 9/11, and was pregnant with the couple's only child at the time of 9/11. And in one of the cases, I should say, actually she gave birth a week before 9/11, it's true, but in the other 3 cases, 2 of them, the wife gave birth in the weeks immediately after 9/11. In one case, the wife was only about 3 months pregnant, and we had to wait 6 months. We had to wait 6 months to see whether the child would be a viable child or not, so that we would know whether the woman, after we were able to determine that the husband had definitely died, we would be able to determine whether the woman required chalitza or yibum, or she didn't require chalitza or yibum. It happened in that case that she had a prior miscarriage, so there was a real concern. Maybe she'll miscarry again. One of the questions that came up, unfortunately, this is a question that now has been posed to us in connection with the Surfside tragedy that just occurred, you know, in Florida, Rahman al-Islan, where there were all these people who were missing and so forth. And the question was, when do you permit the relatives to begin sinning Shiva? If there's an assumption that a relative has died, and an immediate relative has died, but they haven't recovered the body yet and buried the body yet, so what point in time does the family begin sinning Shiva? And the general answer that's codified in Shulchan Aruch is, Mishin Siyashvu, in the Bakish. This is codified in Simon Shinayin Hay, Reishayin Hay, I think, in Hilchas Avelos, where the Shulchan Aruch says that in the event that you have a man who is assumed to be dead, and relatives have given up hope of recovering the body or the majority of the body, Rosho, recovering Kulo or Rubo of the body. So at that point in time, that's when the Avelos begins, assuming that you have enough evidence that the person has definitely died. But let's say that there isn't ironclad evidence. It's not like a Kivshan Eish situation. It's more like a situation that the Gemara talks about of Mayim Shein Lam Sof. You have a man who disappears in waters
which are not circumscribed, like an ocean, like Lake Michigan or something like that. I live near Lake Michigan in Chicago, where if a person fell into the water, you wouldn't necessarily, you saw the person fall into the water, you wouldn't necessarily know if they had emerged at some place much further further down in the ocean, where your eyes are not able to see where the person may have emerged. Maybe the waters had cast the person though it had been buffeted by the waters and the winds at a much further location in the ocean, and the person did emerge, but you just didn't happen to see the person emerge. So the majority supposition is that the person died, that they did drown, but you can't say 100% for sure that the person drowned, and we don't permit a woman to remarry just based on a majority supposition. So therefore, we would have to rely upon other pieces of evidence that would put us over the top, so to speak, and it takes some time to accumulate those additional pieces of evidence to enable the wife to remarry. So the Shach says that whenever you have this kind of like Mayim She'elem sof situation, where you don't have all of the pieces in place to definitely say, from the standpoint of the Beis Din, that the woman is permitted to remarry, so then the woman is not, the wife of such a man, is not allowed to begin sinning Shiva, until such time as the Beis Din has paskened, until such time as the Beis Din has rendered its determination. So it happens in this case, where the woman was 3 months pregnant, it wasn't 100% conclusive. This wasn't a man who worked in Cantor Fitzgerald and somebody spoke to him after the airplane hit the building. This was a man who worked in the cell tower of the World Trade Center. In the cell tower of the World Trade Center, the building was hit in a different fashion, in a zigzag fashion, on the 78th floor of the building. And there still was, after that, after the cell tower was hit, there was still one viable stairwell that went down from above the point of impact to below. And there were approximately 7 or 8 people who were known to have gone down that stairwell. The stairwell was not in the best of shape, and the people, when they reached the bottom, they were all filled, they were all soiled, and they were all, you know, they were in a dilapidated state and so forth, but there were 7 or 8 people who managed to find their way down. So you couldn't say just because the person worked on a floor which was above the 78th building, that they 78th floor of the building, that they definitely have been killed. And I think in this particular case, the man actually worked below the 78th floor of the building. But there was evidence and there was testimony that this man was so caring about his co-workers that he was trying to get all of them to safety and getting them to leave the building in the South Tower before it collapsed. But at the time that it collapsed, he was apparently still in the building. But that's not a Mayim, that's not a situation which is like Kipshon Eish, falling into a fiery furnace, or what the Gemara refers to, Mayim Sheyesh Lehemsof, where you see that a man falls into a circumscribed boundary of a circumscribed body of water, and there was one witness who sees the person fall into the water and waits enough time that the person doesn't emerge, where they definitely would have drowned, and they would have seen the person emerge because it's a small lake, it's a circumscribed body of water. So this wasn't like Kipshon Eish, it wasn't like Mayim Sheyesh Lehemsof, it's more like Mayim She'ein Lehemsof. So the question was that this particular case had been submitted to our Beis Din for determination, and it was assumed by pretty much everybody, of course, that the man was definitely dead, but we couldn't make that determination because it was only like a Mayim She'ein Lehemsof situation, because there was a possibility that he could have survived. Eventually, we had to wait until we were able to accumulate DNA evidence, because they found some remains, and they were able to identify remains of a body through DNA, through the special coding that every single person has in their cells, and there had to be a whole discussion about whether DNA evidence was considered to be a simen mufak, an ironclad form of identification, which is sufficient to identify a man as dead so his wife can remarry. Eventually, the postkim came to the conclusion that DNA evidence is either a simen mufak, an ironclad form of identification, or karavla simen mufak, or very, very close to it. So if you have other circumstantial evidence, like you knew the man was in the building trying to escort other people to safety, and then the entire building collapsed, so you could put the two of those things together in order to permit the woman to remarry, but that took some time. And there was a concern that this woman needed the comfort and the closure of being able to sit Shiva, being able to go through a mourning process. She didn't want to wait until the Beis Din would finish its determination. The DNA had not even been discovered at that point in time. So the question was, could you allow her to go against the Shach, who says that we don't allow the mourning of the widow until such time as the Beis Din has completed its determination? Because we're worried people see that she's mourning. They'll think it's permitted for her to remarry, and then she'll go and she'll remarry before such time as the Beis Din has actually permitted her to remarry. So does she have to worry about that Psach? So we found the tshuva of the Ksav Sofer. The Ksav Sofer paskins that, in fact, the derivation that the Shach made from the Halach and the Shulchan Aruch is not correct. That the Shulchan Aruch, when it was focusing on a Mayim Sheyesh Lehemsof situation, and said that mourning begins once they have despaired from finding the body, so really that was saying even in a Mayim Sheyesh Lehemsof situation, you wait until they've despaired from following the body. But it doesn't mean to exclude a Mayim Sheyesh Lehemsof situation. It says if everybody knows that a Beis Din is dealing with a matter, And everybody knows that the Bezdin, it's public information, that the Bezdin is accumulating evidence, it's accumulating information, that the woman's not going to be able to remarry until the Bezdin issues its ruling. So since everybody knows this anyway, it's not going to lead to a misimpression or misunderstanding in the event that the Bezdin is going to allow the woman to sit shiva, or the woman will sit shiva on her own. It's not going to lead to a misunderstanding because everybody knows that she can't be married until the Bezdin renders its final opinion. There were prior poskim who are quoted by the Piskei Tshuva who say similarly, who say that that with respect to reciting Kaddish, for example, that the children will be allowed to recite Kaddish because everyone understands that Kaddish is one thing, but when it comes to a woman being permitted to remarry, so she has to wait until the Bezdin's determination. The Ksav Sofer said, why limit that to Kaddish? Let's apply that to allowing the woman to sit shiva. So we went to the rabbi of this woman's community, and we said to the rabbi that because this is such a sensitive situation, you don't want to put him into a situation where she'll have a miscarriage, where she'll be subject to having to do chalitza or yibum, as the case may be. So under these circumstances, you can rely upon the Ksav Sofer, the ruling of the Ksav Sofer against the Shach, Halakha Kedivei Amekah V'Avil. You can rely upon this ruling and authorize the woman to start sitting shiva before. So she sat shiva, and it was very therapeutic for her. And thank God she remained healthy enough, and the pregnancy remained viable enough that she gave birth to a healthy baby boy. Approximately 6 months later, I have one of my sons sitting over here, and he actually grew up with that boy in our town, and they were friendly with each other. So thank God for that, to be able to avert a miscarriage and a chalitza situation, but sometimes you're not able to avert it. We did have two cases in the aftermath of the World Trade Center where, unfortunately, we also had to perform chalitza because there weren't any children, viable children. The man had died young, and our brother was still around, and chalitza, I mean, that part is good, obviously, that the brother was still around, but the brother had to perform chalitza with the sister-in-law in order to permit her to remarry. So what do you do in this type of situation where there is no child, but there is zera, and therefore the potential for a future child to be born? So the Noda Behuda dealt with this situation where, at the time, unlike in our cases where we knew that the women were pregnant, they didn't know that the woman was pregnant. But then, suddenly, like a few months later, it turns out, what do you know, she's pregnant. And she gave birth 9.5 months later. So it's the question, 9.5 months? 9.5 months is a pretty long time to be pregnant. So can we assume that she was pregnant from this husband? Maybe she got pregnant from somebody else. Who knows what happens? So that we would exempt her from a chalitza or a yibum. So the Noda Behuda said, well, it could be that she wasn't actually pregnant at the time the husband died, but maybe it was still the zera of the husband because it takes 3 days for zera to fertilize. Zera, that's why we have paleta shikva zera. If a woman has relations with her husband and then shikva zera comes out of her within 3 days, we assume that it still is potent enough to cause tumor, and that's why she would become tummy. That's why it was necessary for Bnei Yisrael to refrain from being with their wives for 3 days before Matan Torah, so that there wouldn't be any kind of an emission of a shikva zera from her womb, based on having had relations with her husband, and shikva zera can remain viable for a 3-day period and can be metame her if she would emit it during that period of time. So it says in Noda Behuda, maybe she only became pregnant 3 days after the husband died through the husband's zera, but even that maybe would not exempt her from a chalitza or a yibum, because he says, let's ask a question. The halacha is a woman cannot do chalitza for the first 3 months after the husband died. Why is that? Because we're worried that maybe she's pregnant. There's a machlokas in the Gemara whether chalitzas milberis is a good chalitza or not. Rabbi Yochanan says that a chalitzas milberis is a perfectly good chalitza. Reish Lakish says a chalitzas milberis is not a good chalitza. It's completely null and void. Even if it turns out afterwards that a child was not viable, nonetheless, this chalitza does not count. If the woman was pregnant at the time that she did the chalitza does not count. So we're worried for the first 3 months after the husband died. It takes 3 months for hukar uva to recognize that there's an embryo inside. So we're worried that maybe the woman is pregnant and we just don't recognize it yet. So we wait 3 months. So ask the Noda Behuda, if it can take 3 days for zera to fertilize after a man has relations with his wife, why do we only wait 3 months? Maybe we should wait 3 months and 3 days. If it takes 3 months to recognize after a woman becomes pregnant that she's pregnant, maybe the zera was only fertilized 3 days after the man died, and therefore we would only recognize that she's pregnant 3 months after that, which would be 3 months and 3 days. So why is it that we say after 3 months it's good enough for her to do a chalitza? So he says, it must be that if the fertilization took place after the man was already dead, it doesn't count. So that was the argument. So it says that that it's a really good argument, but he doesn't want to rely upon this alone. In any event, The more probable explanation, he said, is that in this case, where the woman gave birth 9.5 months afterwards, she probably became already pregnant before the husband died, and that the child, the fetus, just took a really long time to come out. We know of cases where you kind of use a due date, is a day afterwards, 2 days afterwards, a week afterwards, 2 weeks afterwards, it's just like, hey, it's taking forever to come out. So we know that happens sometimes. So he says that, therefore, he's not relying upon, you know, this svara one way or another. Maybe in other cases it might become relevant, but in this case, the woman clearly is exempt from kli soyibim, because we'll assume that the fertilization of the zera took place even before the husband died. But then later poskim kind of looked at this svara, the Noda Biyuda, and they said as follows. That maybe you can argue in the Noda Biyuda's case, where the relationship that led to the pregnancy of the wife took place in the husband's lifetime, maybe you can argue in the Noda Biyuda in that case, and say that this child would still count to exempt the wife from chalitza or yibum. But if you went even beyond that, and there was no relationship, there was no impregnation that took place at the beginning of the impregnation process, didn't even begin in the husband's lifetime, the zera is just sitting around, and it hasn't even been planted in the wife's womb until 2 years later, after the husband died. So Rosh Yisraeli said that he thinks in this case, everybody should be in agreement that it doesn't count to exempt the wife from chalitza or yibum. And he says, and let's say that the wife would have performed yibum, because we looked and saw at the time that the husband died that he didn't have any children. We allowed her to marry the brother. And now it's going to turn out 2 years later, when a child is born from this leftover zera, that retroactively she will have committed an issur kares. It can't be. He says that would be a violation of Dirachei HaDarchei Noam. Like the Gemara talks about, the ways of the Torah are peace, and that's the reason why, let's say that at the time that the man died, he had a child on the first day, and the child was there. The child, let's say, was 5 years old, whatever, the day that the man died. And then a day later, Chas v'Shalom, unfortunately, the child died. So do we say now that the child died, it turns out he doesn't have any zera, so therefore the wife should have to perform a chalitza or yibam? So we say no, that would be a violation of Dirachei HaDarchei Noam. Because once we see that he left a child, we're going to allow her to remarry. So we're not going to say that once we've already allowed her to remarry, that retroactively we're going to abrogate that marriage, we're going to withdraw that permission that we gave her. So it would be a violation of Dirachei HaDarchei Noam, and therefore the Torah, the Gemara actually darshins to the Torah law based on this principle of Dirachei HaDarchei Noam, that it must be that if she had a child from him at the time that he died, or he had a child from somebody else at the time that he died, and that we permit the widow to remarry, even in the event that the child dies afterwards, because otherwise it would be a violation of Dirachei HaDarchei Noam. So since Rosh Yisraeli, this could also be a violation of Dirachei HaDarchei Noam, because maybe she'll perform yibum, and then it's going to turn out 5 years later that somebody takes a zera and has a child, and we're going to say, oh, retroactively it's an issakar. So it would be a violation of Dirachei HaDarchei Noam. And Moshe Zalman Orbach also paskins the same way. Rav Nassim Gestetner, in a tshuva that was published at the back of the Sefer Chalitza Kehilchosa, so Rav Nassim Gestetner says, I don't agree with this entire cheshbon. Why don't I agree with this entire cheshbon? Because we have this machlokes that we mentioned between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish about whether Chalitza's Mubaris is a good Chalitza or not. Let's say, according to Rabbi Yochanan, who we don't hold like. We hold like Reish Lakish. The Chalitza Mubaris is not a good Chalitza. But let's say, according to Rabbi Yochanan, let's say we had a case where the woman performed a Chalitza when she was pregnant, and then a viable child is born afterwards. Not that it turns out there was a miscarriage. A viable child is born afterwards. So great. It turns out you didn't need the Chalitza altogether because a viable child is born afterwards. Like our case, after the World Trade Center, the woman's pregnant, and then a child is born, and it turns out that the child is completely viable. But there was a Chalitza performed during that time. According to Rabbi Yochanan, does that chalitza count for anything? Does it count for anything that we say that now the brother-in-law is forbidden from marrying any of the sister-in-law's relatives because of the fact that she's considered to be his chalitza? Does it count for anything? So even Rabbi Yochanan, says Tosfos, would agree that chalitza doesn't count for anything. That chalitza is garnished. That chalitza is considered to be null and void. He gives two answers. Tosfos gives one answer because, after all, it's a viable child in this case. And Tosfos says, maybe it has nothing to do with the fact it's a viable child. It has something to do with a separate principle. What does the Torah say is the fundamental reason why you need to have yibum or chalitza altogether? You need to have it. The Torah gives you. Normally we say, ain't that kashin the time of the crop? But here the Torah gives you time of the crop. So the Torah gives you time of the crop. It's a totally different story. The Torah says, v'lo yimaches shemo mi Yisrael, that his name, the name of this man who died, should not be blotted out from the Jewish people. It gives you the reason. Lo yimachesh shmo miYisrael. And it says, Tosos, v'harei ein shmo machoy. The name has not been blotted out, because since there is a child, the child came from the husband, came from this father, so therefore the name has not been blotted out, and therefore there is no relevance with respect to chalitzo yibum. If a chalitzo was performed, it's not relevant. It can't be considered to be a viable chalitzo on any level, even to permit, even to forbid this brother-in-law from marrying the sister, the relatives of the sister-in-law, because of the fact that there's no michoy shame. There has been no blotting out of the name. So says from Nelson Gestetner, based on this Tosvos, that we see that it's not dependent upon how much we attribute the child to some sort of a procreative process that began during the father's lifetime. It's we look at what's the end result. The end result is Shemo Mochoy or not? Has his name been wiped out or not? If there is a child that's brought into the world from the Zera that was left behind from this man, even if it's 5 years later, 10 years later, whatever the case may be, his name is not wiped out, because genetically, biologically, this baby comes from this man's heaven. By the way, as long as it's born into the world by some sort of Jewish woman, it would still be attributable, it would still come from this man, to the extent that we would say that he's considered to be the father on some level. It wouldn't matter whether it was the widow that he left behind or some other woman that goes into a Zera bank and says, oh, I'd like some Zera, please, because I'd like to have a child, and they give her, you know, this Zera, as long as she's a Jewish woman. So according to Rav Nosson Gestetner, because of this, the woman would become exempt from Chalitza Yibum, which could work out very well. Let's say there's a brother, one second, I'll take your question in just a second. Let's say there was a brother, and you'll say, what's the big deal? Have the brother do the Chalitza anyway. Who knows if there'll ever be a child brought about from this Zera or not. You sometimes have a situation of aguna in a chalitza context, and the Gemara talks about this all the time, where you're worried that the brother-in-law is not going to do it. We've had cases in the Beis Din over the years where, believe it or not, there was a man who died without any children, and he left, you know, a few brothers behind, and the brothers did not want to do chalitza for their sister-in-law because they hated her guts. We've had situations like that. We had one situation where they felt she was responsible for his untimely death because she was, you know, such a shrew. So they felt that they did not want to accommodate her to do chalitza for her. And the only way that we were able to get chalitza from one of the brothers was because one of the brothers was going out. He was about to get engaged. And we point out there's a halacha in the Shulchan Aruch that we don't allow one of the brothers to get engaged to another woman until he first performs the chalitza. So because he wanted to get engaged and get married, so that's how we were able to procure the chalitza from him to get him to agree to do the chalitza. And sometimes you have a brother-in-law who just has left the fold of Judaism altogether. That's the case of the Ach Mumer, which is discussed, you know, in the poskim. There were opinions amongst the Gaonim who said if you have a Meshumad who's a brother, so that it says Ki Yeshu Achim Yachdav. That's the opening line of the Parsha of Yibum and Chalitz in the Torah. So it says, what kind of an Ach is this? Ki Yeshu Achim. That's no brother. I know that man. He's no brother of mine. You know, because he's not acting like a brother. So he says, he's Meshumad, so he doesn't count as a brother. But even though there is such a sheet of the Gaonim like that, we don't generally assume that way. We do say that if you know at the time that a couple gets married, that the man only has one brother, and that brother is a Meshumud, so then you should make some sort of a Tanai. You make a condition at the inception of the marriage. Normally we say, Ain't Tanai Benisuin. Big sefer like that in Europe, Ain't Tanai Benisuin. You can't make any conditions when you enter into a marriage. A marriage is final no matter what. It can't be undone through a condition. This is the one case when we allow a condition to be made at the inception of the marriage. We say at the beginning of the marriage, you can make a condition that in the event that the husband dies without any children and he leaves behind this brother who's a Meshumad, so then the entire marriage will become batul and mevutul. Why do we allow it in this case? So the author of the Sefer of Ein Tanai Nabinisuin, Rabbi Yehuda Lubetzky, explains why this case is different from all the other cases. Because the other cases we say that a man is not going to mean the Tanai because he doesn't want Lemafreya retroactively for his Bilos, for his intimate relations with his wife, to be declared Bilos Nus, to be declared promiscuous, out of wedlock relationships. But that's only during his lifetime he cares that it not be bilos nus. Here it's not going to be declared to be bilos nus until he's already dead. At that point he doesn't care. You want to call bilos nus, you can do whatever you want. He's dead. He has nothing to do with it anymore. So only in that case do we allow tanai b'nisuin in such a case. So then we would, you know, have this possibility of doing tanai b'nisuin so that she wouldn't, you know, be stuck with this ach who is a meshumad. But otherwise, if you have a recalcitrant brother-in-law, and this is why there used to be a shtar that was signed at the time that people would get married. For some reason, this practice has been discontinued. I don't even know why the practice has been discontinued, but there used to be a shtar that was routinely signed even if there wouldn't be a brother who was a Meshuman, he had nice brothers. And nobody ever thought that the brothers would fail to cooperate if they needed to do a chalitza. They would sign a shtar chalitza at the time of marriage, if there were any brothers, in which the brothers would sign this document saying that in the event that their brother, who's getting married now, would die without any children, they would agree to do chalitza, and they're not going to give anybody a hard time, and they're not going to demand any money. And if there's any dispute about this, they agree that they're going to submit to the jurisdiction of a particular bezdin, and they're going to follow whatever it is that bezdin says. So we now encourage people, the Nachla Shiva, who has all the halakhic forms, the Heter Iskas, and Tanayim, and Ksuvas, and so forth, the Nachla Shiva, who has all the halakhic forms, includes this, it's one of his halakhic forms. We encourage Rabbanim or Misadve Kiddusha nowadays to have people sign such a form. But in the event, let's say that, you know, you have, you know, some sort of a brother who is, you know, recalcitrant, so this could really be a problem. So this could be a wonderful solution according to Nassim Gishtener. You had a brother, there was no tznai that was made at the time of the marriage. You have a brother who is refusing to do a chalitza. So now it's great. The husband left behind some zera, and the wife says, wonderful, I have a great solution. I'll take the zera, I'll get pregnant, I'll have a child. I won't have to do chalitza anymore. So you might say that, okay, you have sort of a manavshak situation. The husband left behind some zera. So let's say I have a brother-in-law who's willing to do the chalitza. Have the brother-in-law do the chalitza. And then you have the zera lying around in case this woman, years from now, she's not able to find another husband and she decides she wants to have a child. And she's going to use the zera that was left behind by her husband. But there is another wrinkle to this. What's the other wrinkle? So we discussed chalitzas miuberes. What did we say? We said there's a machlokas between Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan about chalitzas miuberes, whether it's good or not. And we pass like Reish Lakish, the chalitzas miuberes is no good. What does chalitzas miuberes mean? Does it mean just that he left behind the wife, the man who died left behind the wife when she was pregnant at the time he died? Let's say he had multiple wives. He left behind one wife, and that wife is not pregnant, but there's another wife who's pregnant. So now the woman who's not pregnant decides she's going to have chalitza from the brother-in-law. Does that chalitza work? So the Gemara says, Mefurish. Hey, I believe in Yavamas. No, that chalitza doesn't work. That's also considered to be chalitza's milberis. If the co-wife is pregnant, that's also chalitza's milberis. So says Rav Yoshev, since the woman doesn't have to be pregnant herself, just even there's a zera in the world that could potentially produce a child, that's going to be chalitza's milberis. If the man left behind zera, that's also chalitza's milberis, says Rav Yoshev. That also is a power of chalitza's milberis. Now, the context of the tshuva was, Rav Yoshev was trying to discourage people from donating zera to the various banks. He said, oh, it's hashkasa zera, and maybe, you know, half-brothers are going to marry half-sisters. And by the way, also, it might lead to a situation where the man doesn't have any other children, he's going to leave behind this zera, and then his wife is going to be stuck forever because she can't even do a chalitza to get remarried because it's going to be considered a chalitza's milberis. So it happens that one of the Talmidim, Rav Yoshev, asked him, do you really mean that? Come on, I mean, this isn't like a regular Mubera situation. Not even like the co-wife situation, because nobody here is pregnant. It's Mechus to Maise. No Maise has occurred with respect to pregnancy. But we also said, it's a good argument, that it's, you know, Mechus to Maise, but, you know, the other argument is also not so bad. So therefore, I think that you have to be machmas. So we had two situations so far, in which the man died, and he left Zera. So you say, what do you do with that Zera? So many poskim say, in such a case, you can destroy the zera. It's not considered to be a shkasa zera at this point in time. Number one, it's for a good purpose to enable the woman to remarry. Number two, I don't have a fetus that's in a woman's womb, so it's not considered to be like an abortion or anything like that. You can destroy, for these purposes, you can destroy the zera. But sometimes the woman, and we've had this, she doesn't want to destroy the zera. She doesn't want to get pregnant from it right now, but she wants to leave it in reserve for the future, and also emotionally, it's very, very difficult for her to destroy, and the husband just died and everything. She's going to destroy the zera that the husband left behind. It's very, very emotionally difficult, but she still wants to perform a chalitza. Can you perform a chalitza under those circumstances? According to Rabbi Yoshim, very, very problematic. We did pose this question to various poskim as to, you know, whether they felt, when push comes to shove, because we had this question, Mamash Lamaisa posed this question to Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita. Herschel Schechter said he thinks it's a stretch. When all you have in the world is the zera and it's mechusa maisa, there hasn't been an actual pregnancy, it's not inside the womb of the woman, to call that a chalitza mubaris is a stretch. Doesn't think you have to be machmir for this position, and therefore you can't perform chalitza under these circumstances. So therefore, we have in fact performed chalitza under these circumstances, and, you know, lo aleinu, to have to deal with these types of shilas, we should only have, you know, cheerful, happy shilas to deal with, but goes to show you some of the cutting edge issues that, you know, bati din nowadays you have to deal with. Okay, have a good night.
Yeah, sure. If there is there in the world and he does get pregnant for it, we say 100% that came from the husband.
Is the phone?
Yes. The case is not.
Oh, I took the wrong phone.